Michael Miller joins us now. He is an economist over at DePaul University and regularly talks to us about big picture things like this. Mike, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing really well, John, and it's great to be with you again.
Last we spoke, where were you?
I was in Bahrain. DePaul has an MBA program on the island of Bahrain, and I was lucky enough to be there teaching a group of 30 eager students who wanted to learn about how to analyze an economy. And we had a great time, learned a lot.
They did, or you did?
I always learn. When you interact with a society like that that is so different than from what we have here in the U.S., I learn from it as well. And I gathered some new data about the Bahraini economy to see how it was doing.
Oh, okay.
And they have a little research problems just like we do.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. Last we spoke, the connection was as clear as it is now. And I was happy to hear that the students were so eager to learn, a point you just made again, that they really are receptive to what an American economist has to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, we had an open house. And so these were people who were thinking, do I want to get an MBA? And they asked, since I was there, they asked me to do a presentation. And I could do whatever my expertise is. So I gave them a summary of the economy of Bahrain. We thought it would go 20 minutes. And with all the questions, it lasted an hour. They said, oh, but what about this? And what about that? And what the king did this? And it was exhilarating to be in that room, as far as I'm concerned, that these people really do have an interest in an economic way of thinking about the economy.
I wonder, though, how similar to ours it is, since they've got oil in the ground, they pump it out, everybody gets rich. Maybe it's not Bahrain, but in some of those countries, the people hardly even have to work. Tell me a little bit about that.
And yeah, one thing you'll see is that the Bahrainis themselves do not do any of the grunt work. They bring in people from Pakistan, India, Philippines, and so forth. So the people who are building the buildings and cleaning the roads and building the roads and so forth, those are all what they call expats. The Bahrainis work for the government, and they work in businesses, private businesses. They don't work physically hard the way that we would say that most people do. All the hard work is being done by others. An interesting number I heard, there's a group within the labor force of Bahrain called domestics, and this would be maids and the nannies and things like this. Of the 150,000 or so that are that in this category, there are exactly zero who are Bahraini. Not a single Bahraini holds a job that is called a domestic. And so it's just not something that there's just a certain breakdown in the economy. There's a certain agreement in the economy that certain people will do these things and certain people will do these other things.
Sounds like a caste system.
It makes it different than the U.S.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if there would be no American, for example, would take the job of being a waiter or a server or a maid or cleaning the local Holiday Inn? Not a single American would do it. That's what essentially they have.
And Americans do those jobs, but I'm not probably the only person to notice and kind of wonder how certain jobs or businesses do tend to fall into certain ethnic groups, I'll be them Americans, say. But if you go to a gas station or a donut shop, or if you see who's cleaning the hotel rooms, there does seem to be a certain delineation there, doesn't there?
There does, and it depends upon what part of the country you're in as well, because, living in places like Chicago, which is so extremely diverse in terms of its population, but you go to Wyoming or parts which are like 98%, I guess you could say 98% white, not a whole lot of immigrants, then the people that will be doing this will be your standard Americans. That would not be the case, for example, in Bahrain, though.
Let's start, and then we'll take a break. But inflation, I began the segment by saying that's the number we're all chasing and wondering how it's going to impact us. And you said that there's only one category that seems to be coming out ahead right now. So start on that.
Yeah, the St. Louis Fed wanted to figure out the key to your income is not exactly how many dollars it is. It's what those dollars will buy. And the problem with inflation is it affects every single household and it reduces how much your dollars will buy. So there's this difference between what we call your nominal income, which is your dollars paid, versus your real income, which is those dollars paid adjusted for inflation. And inflation has been high lately, so they wanted to figure out who came out okay, if anybody, and who was hurt the most or who was hurt the least by the inflation. And the surprising finding was every single category they looked at, except one, had a decline in real wages. In other words, a decline in what their money will buy. And the group that came out with actually an increase in real income were workers under 25, which is extremely unusual that this particular sector of the labor market would have that kind of a labor outcome compared to the other segments of the labor force.
Who are those people, and why are they coming out ahead?
Well, a lot of them, it turns out that the other categories that they looked at were, they have their, for example, the people or the group of workers with the least reduction. So in other words, that inflation hurt them the least were the childless households, people without a high school education, and people who changed jobs. And so the only thing I can tell from this is that what we have is, in fact, that incomes have been rising as they were right before the pandemic. We had most of the increases in real wages pre-pandemic were higher at the bottom than they were at the top. And then the pandemic screwed everything up, kind of. But since then, it apparently is the case that a lot of these lower skilled workers are switching jobs because places, I don't want to say like Wendy's or Chick-fil-A or whatever, all of a sudden they can jump from job to job to job, because these places really need people, and they will offer them more money to come work for them. And therefore, somebody who is willing to jump from job to job, often they will be people who are childless because they don't have to, you know, they could go a little while without an income until they can make the jump. Those willing to take those risks were the ones who had the best pay outcome over the past year. So I just found that as interesting, that normally you would think that stable, long tenure people would be the ones who would have incomes that would go up, you know, as they would raise the amount of productivity they have, their wages would rise. But this study found that it's the people under 25, the ones we usually say are the ones that the labor market usually treats the shabbiest, because they don't have as many skills. They don't have as much experience, that you would think that they would be the ones who would be hurt most by this inflation. And I think partly because they're childless and willing to change jobs, and they're taking jobs at the bottom, which have had to raise their wages just to get people to work there at all.
Right.
They've actually, over time, come out better than those of us who are older, stable, and so forth.
We were talking about inflation a moment ago. And Michael, you said that the one category that has benefited of late, that sees an increase in their real spending, despite inflation, is the people 25 and under. But I'll bet that while people higher up the economic scale are seeing their spending power diminish, they still have more money.
That's correct. Yeah, you know, that's exactly the case. And that's so in some sense, and if these people have some savings that they've put aside, they can actually keep their level of total spending roughly the same, because they'll simply draw it out of savings. It makes them less wealthy. But they just have the ability to spend much more. So, you know, if I had to, that's something you and I have talked about a lot over the past couple of years when you look at macro policy, the idea of something being targeted. I guess if I had to pick, what would be the group of people I would want to have hurt the least? This would be the group, you know, that especially if they can have a good experience, they will continue within the labor market. They won't become discouraged that this is, why bother working if everything I earn can't buy anything? So if I had to help any particular group of people, it would be those at the bottom. And this is one of those cases where the people at the bottom are being hurt the least, which is, I guess, some good news.
Yeah. Well, when we hear stories about people that work at Sam's Club or Walmart, pick the mega stores across the country where the owners are worth billions and the people are on the lower end of the economic spectrum, I think some of us say you ought to make less billions and give more money to those people. Everybody would benefit. They'd have more money to spend in your stores, and we would not have to subsidize your business with federal payments or state grants to these families, these individuals that work in the stores. How do you score that argument, Mike?
Well, you know, I understand that, but by looking at the how much the CEO makes or whatever is not as telling, because we have to remember that many of these businesses work at what we call a very close or a very small margin. Like if you go to a grocery store, they only make a very small margin on every dollar of sales. They don't make a lot of money. They make a tiny little bit of money. And then also the money has to then be divided up among all the owners. So the key would be to see, are there industries where their rate of return, say on their stocks or dividends or whatever, is way above the average? That would be a case then you might say, well, maybe that company is, in a sense, grabbing profits at the cost to the employees. But if you do have a business which is just making a normal rate of return, and even though it's billions of dollars, it is billions of dollars spread among many, many, many owners like you and me in our retirement funds and so forth. And so it's not as though there might be one person who's making a lot of money, but the company per se is not necessarily making money on the backs of the people, because they're not making profits over and above what would be the normal profit that businesses would make.
Talk to me a little bit about the housing market right now and interest rates and mortgages. What are you seeing there?
Oh, you know, that again, one thing I always watch is things come across my desk from research. And there was always this question of if mortgage rates are going to rise, if the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates, and sometimes they do so in a surprising way, they raise it by more or less than people think, do housing prices respond? And it was used to be thought it would take months for the housing prices to change once the Fed would change its policy. Now we're finding, based upon the research, that within 2 weeks of the announcement that mortgage rates are going to go up because of the Fed's actions and so forth, housing prices begin to immediately adjust, that you will see a softening in the price of the house. Or the person selling it says, well, heck, if I'm going to sell my house and the person who's going to buy it has to pay so much more in interest,
yeah,
I'm going to have to meet them in the middle, yeah, and offer my house at a price that's, you know, more reasonable. And we're seeing, you know, we know that housing prices in general have fallen 7 months in a row, and that's very much in lockstep with what the Fed has been doing. But it's that time frame. It's that we're seeing housing adjust within literally 2 weeks, not months. It's, yeah, 2 weeks, and house prices begin to change.
Is the flip of that true? If interest rates tick down, and they have a little bit of late, if the interest rates go down, do the prices then jump back up?
That's my understanding, that this would be what we call symmetrical. It would work in both directions, because the seller would say, hey, look, they can get now, they're getting a 0.5% less. They can pay an extra $5,000 for my house, and yeah, their monthly payment will still be the same. Yeah,
right.
This isn't, there'll be that negotiating process, and we're all give and take, and we just find that with information so available today, that people are responding faster than they used to in the past.
I guess it would say something about the pent-up demand, right? That just a slight fluctuation one way or another, and people are in or out, but there's this audience waiting to jump if they can just find a house at a price they can afford.
That's right. And so there is oftentimes a mismatch between, at least in locations, a mismatch between the number of homes and the, yeah, number of people we have that want them, and creation of households and so forth. Yeah.
Mike Miller's back in the United States of America. How about that? An economist over at DePaul. Michael, we'll call you again. It's always a pleasure to have a conversation with you. Thank you.
I must admit, John, it's a highlight for me. So you take care.
Yeah, likewise. Jane Oates is the president of Working Nation, has been a regular guest with us in the past, and we welcome her back. Hi, Jane. How are you today?
Hey, John. I'm great. I'm worried about all you guys in my favorite city of Chicago. It looks like March is going out like a lion there.
Yeah,
stay
now
safe.
That you mention it, that's the saying. And it did kind of come in like a lamb, so that old adage does seem to be playing out right before our eyes. Where are you? Where do you make your home?
I live right outside of Washington, D.C., so Arlington, Virginia.
Let's talk a little bit about the work world, job listings and degrees. What's on your mind in that area today?
Well, you know, John, when I heard I was coming on with you, and I was, I'm always so pleased to join you and the wonderful Pete, your producer, but I thought I'd play around a little bit in the job boards in and around Chicago. And two really interesting things that I see, first of all, there's lots of open jobs. But, you know, we've touched on in the past that people are, there's a move, you know, Opportunity at Work is running a national campaign to take the bachelor's degree off of job titles where it's not necessary. And I have to tell you, John, going through Career Builder and Indeed, I still see bachelor's degrees on a lot of jobs in Chicagoland.
I also have been hearing that a lot of jobs that are posted aren't really jobs, that a lot of companies post positions. I don't know if they call them ghost positions or jobs, but they really aren't hiring, and yet they've got a thing out there sort of encouraging people to apply. Have you noticed that, too?
Yeah, I think whenever you see that a job, some of these boards tell you how long the job has been posted, and sometimes it can mean the employer's having trouble finding the right talent. Other times it means the employer just wants to look like they're growing, or the employer wants to get a scent, you know, get a sniff for what the talent pool is out there in case they might need to hire them quick, fast, and in a hurry. It really is unfair to job seekers. You know, somebody puts their resume in, doesn't hear anything for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then sees the job is still posted. You know what they think, John. I would have thought the same thing when I was at a different stage in my career, that I wasn't worth, you know, I wasn't a good candidate for the job. It really impacts your confidence.
It is so disheartening, and I know people that are going through that. Entry level, young people, people in their 50s who have lost their job, have been downsized during the pandemic. They're still good, valuable workers, and they hear nothing back. And sometimes it's because it wasn't even really an offer to begin with. So
That's exactly right.
I don't know the solution to that, but it'd be nice if there was a bot, some chat GPT thing that could communicate honestly back to people. Let's go back to your point a moment ago about college degrees, though. What's going on there? Are companies taking the bachelor's requirement off? We've been hearing that. Why don't you see that being posted?
Well, I always like to test a theory, right? So you hear all these CEOs saying, we're going to remove the bachelor's degree from jobs where it's not going to, where it's not necessary, where that those skills aren't necessarily required to do a good job. We're going to look at people who learned the hard way on the job, you know, who didn't go and finish their degree, but they've been a great employee. I mean, it's so important. And then, so why, what I like to do is go and look on job boards. And you know what? I did that on three different job boards for Chicago this morning, and I really didn't see any reduction in the number of jobs that are asking not only for degrees, but years of experience. Those poor kids coming out of University of Chicago and DePaul and other places, I mean, they're coming out. Where were they supposed to get the experience? They went to school full-time. That was their job. But I'll tell you what I did see that's interesting, and this is a good tip for your readers, your listeners. There are a lot of jobs in Chicagoland right now are for Salesforce, you know, Salesforce administrator, Salesforce tech, Salesforce business analyst. They're asking for that skill. And, you know, before you spend your money on anything else, if you go to Salesforce.com, their website, they allow you to take all the courses to get those certifications for free. And I wouldn't even bring it up, except I couldn't believe, you know, I would go in and randomly select jobs, and I would say 3 out of 5 jobs had a requirement to know the software programs that Salesforce sells.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago. This is a guy that regularly comes on with us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. In fact, sometimes hosts this show. His name is Tom Gimbel. And he says to those DePaul and University of Chicago graduates who are having trouble getting jobs in their field, he says, here's what you do. You go get a job washing the dishes or answering the phone at Business X, and you work your way up. He doesn't have a lot of patience for this expectation for a good job in a field because the experience that you get starts at the ground floor. What's your thought about all of that?
I think he's really smart. I think he has good advice. Getting your foot in the door, getting people to see all your durable skills, that you know how to come in on time, you know how to pitch in, work in a team, you know how not only to do your job but help other people do their jobs when they need it. I think those are unbelievable skills that you can't put them on paper. Who's ever going to say, "Hey, I'm not a good people person," or I don't have grit"? Who's ever going to say that, right? But this is an opportunity that the employer and the managers can see all these skills in you, and I think you move up pretty quickly.
Do you endorse, Jane, the idea that we don't have to have a college degree to do a lot of these jobs? I know the state of Pennsylvania, I think maybe Utah did this, they're unlisting that requirement. But what do you make about the value of a college degree for a lot of jobs?
So, you know, John, I'm so conflicted on this. I'll be honest with you. I think that anybody who has the opportunity to go to school and get a degree should. You know, I think you should be really careful about thinking about what your passion is and what's an in-demand job. I think you should pepper all the great classes that you take with really good work-based learning, paid internships, jobs that you can, you know, lots of businesses now have classes where you can put jobs, skills together and things like that. I take all those business opportunities. But you know what? I'm not a young person, and I've been through a lot of recessions. And in every single recession, the person with a bachelor's degree is either less likely to get laid off or can get a new job quicker. So I'm not jumping on the train that says nobody needs college anymore. I don't believe that. But I do believe that if you're 40 and you've been working for 22 years since you left high school, that you have valuable experience that could be equal to or better than a college education. And I think that employers have to embrace both. And you know, an 18-year-old, no question in my mind. I think you can choose to get an associate's degree, go to the great city colleges of Chicago, get an associate's degree, do an internship, and then get a job so your employer pays for your bachelor's degree, your last 2 years of school. But I'm not walking away from the college degree yet, and I think people should think long and hard before they say, oh, I don't have to go to college.
That's Jane Oates, president. You can click around at workingnation.com, workingnation.com. That's where she is. Hey, Jane, let's do it again. It's always nice to talk to you.
John, love talking to you. Don't let that DePaul person push me out. He was wonderful, but I still love you more.
That DePaul person was Michael Miller. And all right, our next guest is somebody from Stan's Donuts. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Let's get you more business news first, though. Here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The proposed merger of Chicago's Oak Street Health and CVS Health is moving forward. The Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission allowed an antitrust waiting period to lapse this week without taking action that would have stopped the merger. While the move does not stop regulators from taking action later, it is a sign the process is advancing. The two companies announced the $10.6 billion acquisition in February. If the transaction is finalized, Oak Street would become a subsidiary of CVS. A Chicago startup that uses artificial intelligence to make collecting, trading, and sports cards less of a chore has picked up some new funding. LUDX raised $8 million in the latest funding round. Former Chicago Bears linebacker Brian Urlacher is one of the backers of the company. LUDX lets newbie and experienced collectors alike scan and price their cards, including sports cards, Pokemon, and other cards. The app launched last year and already has more than 200,000 users. The company's headquarters is in Chicago's River North neighborhood. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, here we are. Final Four Friday, and we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Yes, another challenge to our heart health this weekend with the Final Four. The women's semis are today, the men's tomorrow. And beyond the wooden floors, basketball owes a lot to agriculture. The first hoop, or basket, used by the game's inventor, James Naismith, was a peach basket. They didn't hold up too well, and steel hoops came along. But in the 60s and 70s, players were dunking and those rims were being bent and pulled down. And that is where Art Errett of Verdon, Illinois, entered hoops history.
And he said, you know, there ought to be some way to keep that from happening.
That's John Beatty, a farmer near Springfield and friend of Mr. Errett, who passed away in 2015. He was the manager of the local co-op elevator. And over their morning coffee one day in 1975, they decided to go to Beatty's insulated and heated farm shop and work on Errett's idea for a breakaway rim.
We tried a lot of different things, rubber hoses and rubber belts, and eventually came to this design that it is today.
The design that worked best was with springs from a John Deere cultivator that they altered in Mr. Beatty's shop.
We just finally came across the right one. It was a hit-and-miss deal.
Mr. Errett applied for a patent in 1976, and after some exhibitions of the rim, which he called the rebounder, it started being used in games.
Really, one of the first times they were really used officially was in a little Waverly High School in the Waverly tournament, Christmas tournament.
And after Daryl Dawkins broke a couple of backboards, the NBA adopted the breakaway rim, which Mr. Errett had licensed and was being mass-produced.
He contracted with, I think it was, the name of it was Huffy.
Did you ever hang on the rim, Mr. Beatty?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not a very big guy. I only weigh about 125, and it was all I could do to pull it down. These big boys pull them down now. They come right back.
And as you're watching the slam dunkers and rim hangers, remember, it all started on a farm in Sangamon County. From the farm to your belly, today's National Tater Day. It's also National Clams on the Half Shell Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Rich Labriola joins us now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us. I'm sorry we're doing this over the phone. I'd much rather you be in the studio with me and a big box of donuts, Rich.
That would have been great, yeah, for sure.
Stan's Donuts founder and chief doughboy. Let's tell the story real quick of Stan's Donuts. This is your 16th restaurant. Am I counting them correctly?
That is correct, 16th.
And when did it start? When and where was the first one?
The very first one was in Westwood, California, started in 63, and then we kind of took over from the Chicago 9 years ago. So we started on North and Damon Avenue, and that was our very first one in Chicago.
Hmm. So are they nationwide, or are they just a Chicago area thing?
Right now, we're just Chicago. Just the 16 stores, and we have some stores in Mariano's also.
How do you carve out a space when there's Dunkin' Donuts and local bakeries and everybody's got their favorite donut shop? How did you guys sort of make your mark? What's the difference?
I think the difference is we just, you know, you got to be better than the competition, and we believe we are. We put a lot of work into our donuts and our coffee and our drinks, and you know, I think we've shown that we've risen above and probably the biggest pure donut shop locally owned in Chicago by far. And we just keep improving the quality every day. And if someone wants a sweet good, it better be good if you're going to take the calories. So that's our mission.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I think a lot of us have said that before, where you've got a cookie or something, and you go, if I'm going to eat something that maybe I'm not going to eat every day, then it better be worth it. I think one of the appeals of your donuts, and tell me if you agree and if this is intentional, it's the appearance of it, too. Like, yeah, it's got to taste good, but they're little works of art, aren't they, Rich?
They are. They really are. They're, you know, we have a lot of people every night hand-cutting donuts and decorating them, and they look as good as they taste, for sure.
How did the pandemic impact you guys? Did you maybe survive because people were jonesing for something and they were ordering out your donuts?
Yeah, we do. You know, obviously, we do a lot more carry out now, and we just, you know, persevered through it. You know, some stores closed for a few weeks. But as soon as we could open them back up, we did. And things are pretty close to back to normal, fortunately. So I think we're blessed when it comes to that. But you just got to keep forging ahead every day. That's what we've done.
How many people does one of your stores employ?
Between full and part-time, about 25 to 30.
Yeah. And then do you have trouble getting people? Granted, one of my dream jobs is at a donut shop, so I would happily work there.
I got an application for you then.
How about it?
It is a little difficult. I think people are trying to figure out what they want to do in their lives, and but we have a lot of great people, and yeah, there's a lot of great growth, and so that that allows you to hire great people because they see a path to the future and what it could be someday. And so I think we're very fortunate. We have a great crew and great leaders.
Stan's Donuts and Coffee is opening a new location in Rosemont. The grand opening is tomorrow, starting at 6 a.m. The first 100 guests are able to win the Golden Donut. You get free donuts for life. The first 100 people even get a T-shirt and a box donut. And that's starting at 6 a.m. at 9433 West Higgins Road in Rosemont. Anything else we should know about the grand opening of the new location?
Just line up early. I think people start coming out at midnight sometimes to line up to win those donuts for life. It's such a great event. People are excited about it. And, you know, if you look at the past winners, they're ecstatic about winning donuts for life. I mean, it's just something special.
Do those people try and bankrupt you, the donuts for life people?
No. We have a certain amount that we give, and you know, we want them all to be healthy, so there's only a certain amount we give away every month, but it's for life, and so hopefully someone has it for a very long time.
Okay, good luck to you, Stan. Congratulations on the success of Stan's. I said Stan.
It's okay.
I'll bet that happens. Congratulations,
Richard. A little bit.
Good luck on the new stands. Take care.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
You betcha.